10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. Part one will feature a conversation about the United States Supreme Court and some of their most important decisions handed down over the last half century. In part two, we're going to preview for you the plant sale that is coming up this weekend, presented by the Four Seasons Garden Club. Here's part one. I am excited to be able to speak for the next few minutes with a professor of law at the University of Kentucky, Josh Douglas, with whom I have spoken once before. On this occasion, we are talking about his latest book, and a hard-hitting book it is, called The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. Professor Douglas, in this book, makes this statement: the Supreme Court of the United States is anti-democracy and has been for far longer than you might think. And goes on in this book to explore what he regards as 9 landmark cases in which he believes the U.S. Supreme Court handed down decisions that have in one way or another undermined voting rights in America. And we're going to be talking about this book and some of the concerns which have prompted Professor Douglas not only to write the book, but to write the book in the language that he has chosen. It is a book that not only, in a sense, sounds the alarm in terms of voicing his own concerns, but also suggests some intriguing reforms of the U.S. Supreme Court. The book is titled, once again, The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights, published by Beacon Press. Professor Josh Douglas, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
Although I characterize the book as hard-hitting and frank, I don't think you would dispute that wording. I do want to mention the fact that the dedication is rather sweetly framed. You dedicate the book to Caitlin and Harrison. Tell our listeners who Caitlin and Harrison are and sort of the nature of this dedication.
Yeah, they are my kids, my pride and joy, and obviously the people that are the most important to me. And, you know, I decided to dedicate the book to them as a message both to them when they eventually read the book, as all future kids and future generations. You know, it's we work on these issues because we want to protect democracy for our future generations, in addition to ourselves. And it's them that are going to have to take the mantle of trying to continue this, you know, and get to a more perfect union. And so, you know, when I wrote the book and as I was writing, I had them always in the back of my mind. And so it seemed fitting to dedicate the book to them as well.
So in the quote that I shared at the top of the introduction, in which you say, again, the Supreme Court of the U.S. is anti-democracy and has been for far longer than than one might think. Exactly how far back do you trace this pattern of the U.S. Supreme Court issuing decisions that you see as terribly and cumulatively detrimental to the concept of voting rights?
Yeah, it goes back about five decades. And perhaps that's the most surprising aspect of my research for this book. I think most people in the general public who are concerned about the Supreme Court and its decisions on voting rights think of it as something that's occurred in the past 10 years or so. You know, we hear constant stories currently about the court undermining the Voting Rights Act. Many people have heard of the Shelby County decision from 2013 that gutted an important part of the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965. People have heard of Citizens United, a case about campaign finance, money in politics from 2010. But I start the book with cases from the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s that set the foundation for the court's current approach. And the reason I think this is concerning in part is because the Supreme Court is not announcing a new standard or new rule on its under protection of the constitutional right to vote. It's pointing to these previous cases. So the court can say, hey, you know, we're just following precedent. And it's so these previous cases that I discussed that, again, laid the foundation and groundwork for what the court is doing today.
This might seem like an odd place to pose this question to you, but I'm going to anyway. In a nutshell, how would you characterize the position of the Supreme Court in these decisions, generally speaking at least, in terms of how they would defend these decisions? That is, on what grounds has the Supreme Court made these rulings? What were they, in effect, trying to defend, or what concept were they trying to uphold? And again, I realize I'm asking you to speak on behalf of Supreme Court justices who obviously see this concern far differently than you do, but nevertheless.
I think that's a fair question, actually, because, you know, as lawyers, we're always trained to understand the other side's best arguments and explain why they're wrong. So I'm happy to do so with respect to the ideas in this book. I've characterized the overarching theme of the Supreme Court's approach to voting rights and election law as undue deference to the states. That is to say that previously in the 1960s, the court had scrutinized very carefully and questioned state laws on voting to ask, do they harm the constitutional right to vote? And do the states have a really good justification for its voting rules? The approach today is opposite of that. The court basically says, we're going to trust the states to run elections as they see fit. We don't have the expertise in election administration, and so we're going to defer to states in their election rulings. But here's why that's problematic. Maybe that sounds good in the abstract, and you might say, look, if you don't like the rules that the states are setting out, well, the classic American response is to vote the bums out, right? But here's the problem. Voting rights is an area in which we should trust politicians the least for two reasons. One, they're not experts. You know, many politicians think, you know, I won an election, I ran a campaign and won, so I know what the best rules are for an election. But the election officials will tell you that that's not true. Just because you ran for office doesn't mean you know how to run elections. But I think the second problem, and the more concerning one, is that voting rights is the one area where we should trust politicians the least because they're most self-interested. Right? What's the number one goal of a politician? You know, you'd hope it'd be the virtuous goal of representing their constituents, but the reality is that the number one goal is to win re-election. Well, wouldn't it be nice if you could change the rules or make sure the rules are such that your supporters can vote more easily and your opponent's supporters have a harder time passing a ballot? And that's exactly what you see politicians doing in passing these rules. So if there's any area where we should have a politically independent body scrutinize the laws, it's voting rights. It's the one place where we shouldn't trust the politicians because they are so self-interested. So I think the court, to defend itself, would say, you know, we're giving this to the people's representatives, and if you don't like it, vote the bums out. The problem is that the bums are essentially rigging the game to make it harder to vote them out.
Right. I want to also mention the fact that I think sometimes a complicating factor is that sometimes I think we have I'm not saying this is necessarily such an instance, but I think it is possible to have an instance in which there is a law, one upholds that law, and there are consequences to that that might be pretty much entirely unintended. That bad things might happen through the upholding of that law, but if one believes that that's my job, to uphold whatever the law is, then it's not a matter of thinking about, well, if I do this, if we allow this law to remain in place, then these bad things will happen. I mean, I think some might argue that that's not necessarily the only way to decide a particular decision. I don't know how.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem here is that we're too focused in general on the political ramifications of a law, right? So, you know, let's get more concrete. You have a law that imposes a strict photo ID requirement to vote, or you have a law that says how many drop boxes there can be and where they're located for voting. And the motivation often for these laws is to try to achieve a political outcome, or, you know, we can get even more concrete and talk about partisan gerrymandering, right? Drawing the district lines in a particular way to favor the politicians. And all of that, the motivation for those laws is typically to try to achieve a partisan advantage, not let's make sure we have the best election system and let the chips fall where they may. And so, you know, again, I think the court is being too deferential to the state legislatures in passing these laws without recognizing that it's hard to vote them out if we don't like the laws that are being passed. And there could be consequences, as you note, for that most important value underlying our Constitution, the constitutional right to vote. And, you know, the right to vote, if voters are paramount here, we'd have a very different election system than we do today.
Hmm. We're speaking with Josh Douglas, professor of law at the University of Kentucky, about his latest book called The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights. The book examines 9 Supreme Court cases that Professor Douglas believes have severely undermined voting rights throughout our country. Each one sometimes on its own, and certainly cumulatively, as Professor Douglas would argue, a whole series of Supreme Court decisions dating back to 1983. I want to mention that your book begins with this sentence: "I couldn't believe my eyes," and what you are referring to is the assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. And you go on to say, January 6th revealed the fragility of our democratic institutions in a way that sickened so many for us. And then you go on to say, the Supreme Court is not blameless for what happened that day. How would you trace this series of decisions impacting voting rights with what happened on January 6th?
Yeah. Now, of course, the court wasn't involved in January 6th directly, and I don't try to make that sort of claim.
Of course.
But I do think the court has created a culture in which we and politicians can exploit the legal rules to try to achieve victory, and in particular has made it such that an election win is not actually over, because we can always think we can fight in post-election disputes. You know, why did the individual stormed the Capitol, you know, because, you know, spurred on by President Trump. Well, he made them think that the system had been rigged against him and that the courts would do his bidding. And, you know, he filed, what, over 60 lawsuits. Virtually every single one of them were frivolous and thrown out. But he planted this seed that the proper remedy for, you know, his perception of election fraud, which, of course, there was zero evidence to support that claim. But the seed was there that the courts were the answer. And the courts were the answer because the Supreme Court has opened the door to fight so many of these issues in the courts. And it's partially Bush v. Gore, the case that ended the 2000 presidential election. But it's other cases as well in which the court has said, essentially, again, the voters have less importance than the politicians in terms of the voting rule. So, the court obviously was not involved in January 6th, but I think the culture that we have in thinking about election law in this area is attributable to many of the court's decisions.
As I say, the balance of your book is an exploration of these nine landmark decisions, and I realize I misspoke saying that the earliest was 1983. You actually touch on a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1974, Richardson versus Ramirez, in a chapter titled The Stigma of Felon Disenfranchisement. I wonder if we could just spend a second talking about this particular facet of this larger issue. I mean, this is a facet of it that is a little different from some of the other things we're talking about, but you obviously felt it was of sufficient significance to give it this kind of attention.
Yeah, and this is a question I'm asked all of the time. If the Constitution protects the right to vote, if the right to vote is one of the most fundamental rights in our society, in our constitutional democracy, then why is it that states are allowed to take away the right to vote to people with a felony conviction? And it's a great question, right? And so I explore what happened in Richardson versus Ramirez, where the Supreme Court said, essentially, that the Constitution allows felon disenfranchisement. Now, the reasons why I get a little technical and into the weeds on the law, and I, you know, this book is for the general public, and I try to kind of go through in simple terms why the court found a right to disenfranchisement, to felon disenfranchisement in the Constitution. It has to do with this somewhat forgotten clause in Section 2 of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is one of the Reconstruction Amendments, along with the 13th and 15th, passed after the Civil War, and essentially a response to the Civil War. The 13th Amendment abolishes slavery. The 15th Amendment says that you can't deny the right to vote on the basis of race. And the 14th has a whole bunch of stuff in it, including what's known as the Equal Protection Clause, that says that the government has to treat everyone equally, and that's where the court has located protection for the right to vote. There's what's known as the Due Process Clause, which essentially protects fairness from government. And buried in there in Section 2, the court found, was a right to felon disenfranchisement. Now, I traced the history of this clause, and other scholars have as well, and show that really those who wrote the 14th Amendment never intended it to be a blanket prohibition on denial of the right to vote for individuals with felonies. So I think the court was wrong in this decision, but it does say that even though the right to vote is inherent within the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, this other phrase in the 14th Amendment allows states to take it away.
Towards the end of your book is a chapter with the title The Next Looming Case. And one of the reasons this chapter was of special interest to me is because of the specific mention of the state of Wisconsin at the start of it. Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about, and more importantly, the next looming case that you see in this long succession of crucial Supreme Court decisions that impact this issue.
Yeah, I start the chapter with the story of Wisconsin voting during the pandemic, the very early stages of the pandemic, and a photo that went viral of someone standing in line, masked up, because it was, you know, April of 2020, the early part of the pandemic, and this woman had written a sign that says, "This is ridiculous," referring to the fact that she was having to wait in a long line during a pandemic. And that gives me actually an opportunity to point out, by the way, that this book is full of stories. The way in to all these issues is not through legal theory, but through stories of people, stories of the litigants in the cases, stories of the lawyers, stories of the judges. To me, the stories are the rich part of this narrative, and it helps to explain the way in which the court has underprotected the right to vote, because it's individuals, it's people that are the ones who matter most in our democracy. So I tell the story of this photograph in Wisconsin and this woman who had to wait in line, and the reason she did is because the courts had refused to issue rulings protecting voters in the wake of the pandemic after the Wisconsin legislature refused to change the rules as well. And of course, we had such an unprecedented situation of how do we run a election in a time when so many were fearful of the spreading disease. And one of the reasons, and this get the legal issue that this gets into, is what's known as the independent state legislature doctrine. This is a phrase that kind of was in the media a bunch as the court was considering a case called Moore versus Harper. And the basic question is, can the U.S. Supreme Court overrule a state Supreme Court on a matter of state law and the state constitution? Right? Normally, we would think that the state Supreme Court, the highest court in a state, would be the final say on the state constitution. And the state constitution, every state has a constitution that has a lot more protection than what's found in the U.S. Constitution. So you saw these state Supreme Courts ruling kind of robustly on voting rights when the U.S. Supreme Court refused to do so. And so those, you know, who were unhappy about these state Supreme Court decisions went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then the Moore versus Harper case came out of North Carolina. It was about partisan gerrymandering. The state Supreme Court had struck down the map. So they go to the U.S. Supreme Court and say, essentially, the state Supreme Court doesn't have the power to rule a map unconstitutional under the state constitution. Seems kind of backwards. The court rejected that bold claim. It was really a fringe theory. But it included this little nugget. We're going to reject this bold theory, but maybe there are instances where state Supreme Courts will go too far, and we get to decide when that's happened. And the court didn't tell us what the test would be, how we would know if a state Supreme Court has gone too far. The court just said there's some instances where it's possible state Supreme Courts will go too far in protecting voters, and so we retain the power to decide that in the future. So the next looming case is, you know, what if we have a decision from a state Supreme Court that protects voters, and the state challenges that ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, what will the court say? I don't think we really know.
Your book ends with a couple of very, very important points. One of them is a list of what you see as very basic rights that you can scarcely imagine being a point of controversy for anybody. That every eligible voter should be allowed to vote with minimal burden. The system should acknowledge concerns about the potential for fraud, set up ways to deter it. Voters should be as educated as possible, and elections should be won by ideas, not by the rules of the game or the partisanship of election officials. And losers of elections should accept defeat. So you kind of outline those as bedrock, basic voting rights, voting principles, and of course, talk about them a bit further. What I want to give you a chance to talk about here are the reforms that you are suggesting for the United States Supreme Court. And at the start of this argument, you talk about this notion of packing the court, of enlarging the court the way President Franklin Roosevelt attempted back in the 1930s, when the Supreme Court was, at that point, was standing in the way of his New Deal reforms. And so there's when the term packing the court kind of became known. You are not exactly calling for that, but you are talking about some other reforms that are equally dramatic, but I think you believe them to be fully defensible. Outline for our listeners what you see as sensible and, beyond that, necessary reforms of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Sure. So you're right. I don't think court packing itself is a good idea. You know, the U.S. Constitution does not set 9 as a magic number for the number of justices. It's determined by Congress, and early in our history, there were 6 Supreme Court justices. It's been 9 for over a century now. But that's not a magic number, and Congress could increase it. But my concern is, let's say the Democrats increase the court, maybe they add 6 members, so it's 15. Well, what happens when Republicans take over? Now they decide they want to increase the court to 6 more, and now it's 21. And then Democrats take over, it's 27. It's a tit for tat with sort of no logical endpoint, and also doesn't actually meaningfully change the systemic problems that I think we see with the court. And so the reforms I suggest get to the heart of the matter. And the first is 18-year term limits. I'm not the first person to suggest this. There are organizations that have promoted this idea as well. But the basic idea here is that if you had term limits for Supreme Court justices of 18 years, then every president would have a natural rotation of 2 nominees in every 4-year term. And so we'd have a much more regular change on the court, and hopefully the Supreme Court battles wouldn't be so protracted because, one single nomination wouldn't necessarily change things so much. And, you've got another one coming up in 2 years once this is kind of instituted and there's a regular rotation. The whole idea here is to lower the temperature of the nomination battle. Another idea is maybe we do want to increase the size of the court a little bit, but have the justices sit in panels. So at the federal courts of appeals, you have large member courts, and they sit in 3-judge panels. That sort of idea could work for the Supreme Court as well. Again, the concept here is to make the identity of the justices sitting on the court less important and the rule of law more important. The third idea for court reform is to let the federal appeals and district court, the trial court judges, sit by designation on the Supreme Court occasionally. Again, with a allocation of when that occurs, they already do this at the appeals court level and the district court, the trial level, where sometimes appeals judges will sit and have a trial. Sometimes trial judges will go and be on an appeals court panel, and I think it really helps their work when they go back to their normal court. And I think that could also work for the Supreme Court. There's something magical about being on the highest court, except for the fact that under our current system, the president nominates and the Senate confirms. That's the same thing that happens with the lower court judges. So if we had a regular rotation of judges who were deciding these issues as a Supreme Court, then again, perhaps the identities of the justices would matter less. Right now, we have a very conservative 6-3 Supreme Court, and so we kind of know in all the controversial cases, we pretty much know the decision is going to come down 6-3. Previously, it was 5-4. And previously, it was essentially 5-4 with Justice Kennedy in the middle, and so whichever way he went is how the court went. A system of panels or a system of other judges sitting by designation would hopefully get the focus more on what the law should be and less on ideology.
I really appreciated all that I learned from reading your fascinating book, which is titled The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights, published by Beacon Press. The author, Josh Douglas, professor of law at the University of Kentucky. Professor Douglas, thank you for joining me once again on the morning show. As I did our first time out, I really enjoyed this conversation and learned a lot. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And for part two of today's program, I'm happy to welcome into our studios for the very first time Kendall Victorine, who is a very active member of the Four Seasons Garden Club. And, of course, you hear plenty about them on the morning show, particularly when we talk about their annual Secret Garden Walk. What we want to talk about today is another important event for the Four Seasons Garden Club, their annual plant sale. And that is always on the third weekend of May at Harbor Market. And so that is going to be coming up this Saturday. And Kendall Victorine is one of the people who helps to coordinate the plant sale, make it all happen, make it all go. And we're going to be talking, of course, also about the Four Seasons Garden Club itself and all of the things that it does over the course of the year and has done over the course of its long history, having been around for just over 60 years, if I'm doing my math correctly. So, Kendall Victorine, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
So glad to have you here. I wonder, before we even start talking about the Four Seasons Garden Club, could I ask you a little bit about your own life as a gardener? I mean, first of all, is this something we can trace into, like, maybe your early life, or is this a pleasure that's come a little later to you?
Well, I come to think of gardening as being a kind of a recessive gene. My grandmother on my father's side had a wonderful garden that I still remember. It was framed by two apple trees, and she had a big perennial border. And I remember being there in the summer with the smell of phlox, which are still one of my favorite plants. And my father wasn't really interested. My mother liked flowers but couldn't grow to save her soul. Mm. And when I moved here years ago, I bought an old farm, and I was so excited because I knew it was just going to have this wonderful garden that I could play in, and it ended up having two lilacs that refused to bloom and two peony bushes, which I still have. Well, that's expanded over the time I've been here. So, and then I've worked, I was thinking actually it's about 15 years that I've been working in the landscaping industry, whether it was working for a retail store or for a small landscaping firm. I'm currently at Northwind Perennial Farm in Burlington.
Ah, so this is not only a private personal interest, but it's also part of who you are professionally.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think of it as being professionally, but yes, it makes money.
Very good. Well, it's certainly given you a whole lot of pleasure. And of course, that's true of probably everybody who's been a member of the Four Seasons Garden Club over the years. That's part of course, what it's all about. Before we went on the air, you were sketching a little bit of the history of the organization, which goes all the way back to 1963. And how long have you been a member?
I've been a member since 2009. I had to look that up, but yeah, it's 15 years.
Very good. So for those who have not been part of the Four Seasons Garden Club, or for whatever reason don't really know what you are all about, describe what this organization is and also the kind of really impressive things that you have done over the years.
Well, it is a member of the National Garden Club Association, and so it has to follow certain things that they do, you know, certain sort of mandates that you are. It's a 501c3, so it is a nonprofit, and it's focused on giving money to, you know, to charitable institutions. All of our things are very local. We've given scholarships to Gateway, the horticulture school. We started giving in 1975, And as of this spring, we had donated $46,000 to them.
Wow.
In 1976, we started giving to what was then the Nature Conservancy, which has evolved to be Chiwaukee Prairie. And we have donated over $24,000 there. Every year we celebrate Arbor Day by planting a tree. Most of the unusual trees at Kemper were planted by our club, a tulip tree in 1993, a larch, a ginkgo. Now we are planting them at local schools. Kemper Center has the Margaret Myers Garden in the parking lot by the lake, and that was constructed, planned and built by the Garden Club in 1985. And the club members have maintained it ever since. You will see us out there every weekend. We have different teams working each week to maintain it. This year, we actually started in March because we had fabulous weather for, for cleanup, and we'll go into December, just it all depends on the season. And that's really one of the fun things that we do is we're down there and we're working in the gardens and there's all kinds of people going, on the bike path, driving in, working there. And, when they pass, they'll say, oh, thank you so much for what you're doing here. And, first of all, we always offer them a shovel. We always have extra tools. And it's just a nice thing to, it's one of those sort of daily interactions that you don't think about, but it's just a very pleasant thing. You'll have a conversation with somebody you'll never see again. And that's really what makes life, fun.
Absolutely.
And then, other things, other places that we have donated include St. Matthew's Elder Garden, Hawthorne Hollow, the Dream Playground. So it's a lot of giving. It's all local. And so we've got some. Oh, and then last year also we added on a piece of garden, if you will. There's an additional garden space between the Margaret Myers Garden and the bike path, and we planted 5 Techne arborvitae there. And we plan to add a bench, and we're hoping to develop this into a little tiny pocket park. It's just a little peninsula of space, but it faces the lake and Kemper and the garden, and it's just a very nice area that people could, sit and enjoy.
If I were to ask you who comprises the membership of the Four Seasons Garden Club, I mean, is that a really hard thing to generalize or summarize?
You basically have to have a heartbeat. our membership dropped, as did membership with many service organizations during COVID. And so I think we were under 20 members, but, we got down to the core group who still wanted to get their hands in the dirt. And since then, I think our current membership is like 28. Okay. So we welcome anyone who is interested. Our meetings are the second Thursday of the month at 6:30 at the Faulkner Building, which is on the lake side of Kemper Center. And people are invited to come, just show up and listen to our program and see if they'd be interested in participating.
Right. And I should think probably one of the things you want to say is that someone does not necessarily have to think of themselves as an expert gardener.
Oh, absolutely not. No. People make that mistake. And, none of us are experts. I mean, we all fumble our way through. But you learn. And you learn from other people and you learn from the plants. And,
I guess that would be the thing that probably ties all of you together. I mean, to whatever extent you are experts or not, or experienced or not, all of you want to learn more about gardening.
Oh, absolutely.
And want to get better at it.
Well, and the thing about working with plants is that, they always save you. I mean, they always show up. I mean, not always show up, but when they do, they bloom. That's their whole purpose in life. And it's like, oh, that looks great. I did that.
Yeah, right. Or I had a hand in that anyway.
Right.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking in this part of today's morning show with Kendall Victorine, who is a very active member of the Four Seasons Garden Club. And they have a big event coming up this Saturday at Harbor Market, namely their annual plant sale. You were telling me that this has been going on for roughly 10 years or so, generally.
Yeah, I think so. We, you know, some of the early records are kind of sketchy because it always begins by, you know, those of us who are gardeners can't wait for the first decent day, might be February, it was this year, to actually get out and see what's growing. And so then as time goes on, you go, oh, my God, I've got 1,000, you know, phlox. And so you have to dig and divide, and any gardener hates to throw away a plant. So it just makes sense. Well, I'd like to give this to somebody. Well, you've only got so many friends. And then we got together and said, well, okay, why don't we just take this and, you know, we'll sell it and make some money for the club. So that's how it started. And now we're to a point where last year we sold over 600 plants in that six-hour period. Now, it's a lot of physical work, but it's fun, and we get together, and we make a good time of it.
Yeah. So explain kind of what the setup is. I mean, first of all, exactly where you are at Harbor Market and kind of the way you have things set up to accommodate all of the people who come to visit you.
Well, it is an annual sale, so it's only one day a year. We've settled on the third Saturday of May at Harbor Market because that is a, you know, the weather has settled. I mean, we're right next to the lake, so spring is always late. I mean, I was digging in I live in Bristol, and I'm like 12 miles from the lake. Well, I was able to start digging in March. We couldn't dig in Kenosha by the lakefront until late April. So at any rate, it is located at the southern end of the market at the southwest corner of 2nd Avenue and 56th Street. It is diagonal from the museum. And it's been wonderful over the years working with Harbor Market. They have been very generous and helpful to us. So we have two spaces there on the grass. And we get there early because, you know, we can only set up in the morning. So we set up an entry lane. We do request that customers not start shopping before 9 o'clock because we have a lot to get set up and there's a lot of activity in there. At the entrance, there will be boxes for customers to pick up and put their plants in. The plants are arranged. It is primarily a sale for perennials. We do not have annuals. We don't sell bulbs. Over the years, we've culled those items that don't sell well. People have way too many ferns, way too many daylilies. We will occasionally have, you know, like small shrubs if they have popped up in somebody's yard. But the plants are arranged. We have tables that are for sun plants, shade plants, ground covers, hostas, sedums. This year we're going to have the perennial chrysanthemums, the big, what they are called, football mums, because they're like the corsage size. And because people actually come asking for those, and they're very hard to get. They, excuse me, they didn't used to be. But for some reason, the market just, you know, you plant them now and they will, you know, be gorgeous by this fall. We also have a kind of, it might turn into a little signature thing. We're not sure. At the Margaret Myers Garden, there has always been a vine covering the trellis, the entry trellis, and it's a hyacinth bean vine. It's an annual vine, but it's got great growth, and it produces these, you know, kind of purplish seed pods. It's a very colorful thing. The pods develop over time. And we have people coming and asking us all the time, what is it? You know, are there seeds? So one of our members last year collected the seeds and dried them over the winter, and we're selling those in little plastic envelopes this year. So it'll just be a kind of fun thing to see how that goes. Yeah. Every year we do something a little bit different.
Right.
Okay, so the plants on the tables are arranged alphabetically by botanical name. And there's a very specific reason for that, which is that the botanical name is the only accurate identification of a plant. So Monarda, for example, which is a botanical name, can be known commonly as bee balm, horsemint, Oswego tea, bergamot. And, you know, it's the only really consistent to know what you're actually getting is to use the botanical names.
So this is the way to be precise.
Exactly. And, you know, don't hesitate, because what one person calls Oswego tea, somebody else will call something else. So we're, you know, and we have people in the club, not everyone, but enough people who know the botanical name. So if there's any question. The pricing system is a color coding. So each pot will have an identification as to what the plant is. It will also have a colored stick in it. And then we have signs on the table which designate what the, you know, what the prices are. The entire thing is staffed by garden club members. And think of us as the growers of these plants, because they all came out of our yard. So we know where they do well and what they look good with. So ask questions. We are all wearing pricing necklaces, in other words, around our neck. So we have name tags. So some shoppers in the past have brought shopping lists. And they can say, do you have this, this, and this? And we know ahead of time what we have. The checkout then is under the white tents. We take cash or check only, but there is an ATM available at the museum. Also this year, we have at the end of the checkout, we have a separate table which is selling garden tickets. Linda Guy will be there. And it's an opportunity to get to our next fundraiser, which is the second Saturday in July. And this year it's going to be on the north side, and we've got a wonderful selection of gardens, large and small. And also we are featuring, every year we have a bonus, what we call community garden. This year it's going to be Hawthorne Hollow, so we're very excited about that. Then we also have a holding area behind the tents. If you want to continue shopping at the Harbor Market, we'll set your plants there until you can pick them up. We have some wagons to help you load. And then if you have a lot of plants, you can just drive up on 56th. We'll get you loaded and you can be on your way. So that is the physical, logistical setup for the plant sale.
Very good. It sounds like you've got this pretty much down to a science in terms of having really thought about the details and the way to do this most efficiently.
It is a million details. And so we've done this now, and each year we, you know, take note of, okay, we have a postmortem, a dinner where we get together, the committee, and we sit down and we go, okay, well, what went well? What didn't go well? A lot of times we get suggestions from the shoppers, you know, do you have this or could you do that? And so over time, we try to improve it, because it is a lot of work, as I say, and anything that we can do to make that go more smoothly is always good.
right. So remind our listeners about the time frame that we're talking about on Saturday. And for people interested in visiting the plant sale, what is the earliest that you would be happy to greet them?
Well, I mean, you know, the sale is actually from 9 to 2, so that is how long we are there. Mm-hmm. And like I say, the morning is just, you know, it's pretty frantic there, because we're trying to get everything set up and handling 600 plants. You can imagine putting them in the right places by alphabetical name is not easy.
Right.
So we just request that, you know, if people just wait outside, and then, you know, when 9 o'clock comes, we'll let them come in and shop.
Absolutely. And then the happy mayhem begins. It sounds like great fun, and we hope a lot of people will mark their calendars accordingly. And at least right now, it looks like Saturday is going to be a beautiful day.
Well, anytime you do an outdoor activity, it is always weather dependent. We have found that out.
Yeah, right. So it looks like Mother Nature is on your side in this case.
So we hope so.
The Four Seasons Garden Club will have their annual plant sale this Saturday at Harbor Market beginning at 9 in the morning. Please don't show up any earlier than 9. Give them a chance to get everything set and in place, and they'll be in business until 2 o'clock that afternoon, unless you sell out before 2 o'clock.
Well, right, and the thing is, that I mean, last year it was interesting, because of the 600 plants, I think we had a total of 30 that were left over.
Wow.
And those just simply get donated
to
local. Yeah.
Well, we hope you have a lot of enthusiastic customers on Saturday. Kendall Victorine, thank you for being my guest today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.